back to another episode of the How To Fitness Podcast. I'm Kate Lyman.
And I'm Michael Ijoa.
And we have a deep dive today. Woohoo! These are my favorite. I mean, is that true? I love everything we do. I like Q&As because they're easy.
You have to say that, Kate. You have to say it. I think, yeah, deep dives are my favorite. Like, I love having guests on and meeting new people. That's always fun. Like, I think that's one of my favorite things about having a podcast, kind of meeting new folk. It gives us a reason to reach out and speak to people we haven't spoken to before. But yeah, the deep dives just allows us to kind of nerd out and just chat about whatever we want to talk about. So I think it's my favorite too.
I love it. Now, tell us what we're talking about today.
So today we are going to be talking about the link between what we eat and our mental health. And I know it's a very broad topic. And with this, I could have taken it down so many different routes. So I'm just going to kind of touch on quite a few different topics within that umbrella term. But yeah, it's how does what we eat influence our mental health status and mental health outcomes? And it's, I think it's a fun topic. We're going to nerd out with some research. So I hope people enjoy that too. But it's an important one. One that also is oversimplified a lot within the fitness industry too. So we will touch on that. That's the topic for today.
Ooh, I'm excited. And, you know, I think we have come around to, I'm saying we just like society-wise come around to talking about mental health more. But I feel like it stops at just like acknowledging that that mental health exists, right? Like it's, okay, well, we got that far and there's just so much more to do. So I'm excited about this. I'm excited that you're going to do a nutrition-focused episode. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. And also on that as well is you'll have a lot of people exploiting this area too, because it's the fitness industry and it's what it does best. It takes a topic, it makes a lot of wild claims, and then makes us spend our hard-earned money on it. So hopefully we can kind of cool out a bit of that today and then just have a good old chit-chat, Kate. So should we kick things off?
Yep, let's do it.
Okay, cool. So your brain is always running, whether you are thinking, eating, or even sleeping. And all of this work takes fuel. In fact, your brain uses about 20% of the total energy that your body consumes each day. The energy to support your brain comes from the food we eat, obviously. I'm sure we've all had a time where we got a little too hungry and experienced brain fog. And this inability to focus can often be caused by a lack of fuel. Your brain simply cannot run on empty. In today's episode, we will be taking a look at how our diet can impact our mental health. And this is actually where, okay, I just wanted to put in the little disclaimer as well. So although we're discussing our diets in relation to mental health, I don't want to oversimplify the issue like a lot of the fitness industry does. When I talk today about how food might or might not impact us, I really want to highlight that this is just one piece of a very large puzzle. Social determinants of health always come into play. So there are lots of other factors that influence our mental health status, including socioeconomic background, healthcare access, education, income, discrimination, and so many more topics which we have discussed on this podcast. And I just never want to kind of intentionally ignore those factors. So that's our little disclaimer out the way. So hopefully people don't moan at us that we're kind of oversimplifying or glorifying certain approaches. But
well, I mean, no one wants to listen to a 200-hour podcast, so it's in everyone's best interest, right?
So true. So I guess this is a little bit off script here, but I was just thinking, what food makes you feel good, Kate?
Oh, easy, marshmallows.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, I know. And everyone whatsoever is just like, what? I just feel like people are surprised that marshmallows can be good, but they are. I love marshmallows, and they just make me filled with joy.
Well, this is a whole episode in itself. We're just going to chat about marshmallows. How do you like your marshmallows?
Pink. I like the pink ones. Okay. I don't know. Here in Mexico, there's these pink ones and they're delicious. Yeah. And I specifically like to buy them, eat one or two. They're big ones, like talk about my fist size.
Yeah.
And then leave them out open on the counter for them to get stale and then eat them later.
So does the outside
go like... Is that what you're
asking? Kind of. Well, so does the outside go hard and the middle go soft? Is that why you kind of leave them out?
Yeah, it's like chewy.
Nice.
Instead of just soft.
Are you like in hot chocolate or on a fire? Are you a big fan of that as well?
Yeah. Just all marshmallows. Love them.
Yeah. Emma, my wife, is a massive marshmallow fan too. So we...
Of course she is.
Yeah, she is. We actually had some. We went on a... festive outings. We went to this kind of like light show thing, and they had marshmallows over a flame. And I think Emma had the most fun out of all of us there. Jude was kind of indifferent to a lot of it, but Emma had a marshmallow. She was happy.
So, okay, but do you like roast yours with patience, yeah, or are you a right into the fire and burn it kind of guy?
I always start off with patience, and then my patience dwindles very fast, and then I just shove it in there to speed up the process. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with you. I just right into the fire. Throw it right into the flames. We don't have time for this.
Okay. Well, honestly, there was no point to that question other than I was just really intrigued about what food made you feel good. There we go. I will get some. There's actually, this is a nice little plug for local business here. There's a marshmallow business called The Marshmallow Lady in Edinburgh, and the marshmallows are unbelievable. I will send you some marshmallows, Kate. There we go.
Please. Oh my gosh, I'm very excited for that.
Okay, right. Back to the podcast. So we all know that we need to eat enough food to match our energy demands, showering, commuting to and from work, getting in that workout. But getting in enough food volume is also important for our brains to function effectively, along with eating a range of vitamins and minerals. And as the brain works, its 86 billion neurons are consuming oxygen and producing waste. One byproduct of the brain's work are free radicals that cause oxidative stress and tissue damage. Antioxidants within our diets in foods such as cruciferous vegetables, olive oil, pulses, potatoes, and many other foods work to neutralize these free radicals, therefore protecting the brain tissue from harm. Many vitamins are needed to support brain function too, so vitamins are unique in that many of them are essential but cannot be synthesized by the human body. And this means that we must source vitamins from an external source, like our diets. B vitamins are particularly important for brain health. Vitamins B6, B12, and B9 especially have been shown to improve kind of memory and preserve cognition too. And one thing that always really annoys me about this topic as well on social media is you'll see a lot of people talk about the importance of these vitamins in terms of improving memory, cognition, and then they'll flog a supplement at the end of it. But there's actually very, very little research showing that supplementation and a lot of these B vitamins has benefit. It needs to come from actual food sources. So unless you are kind of notably deficient, you're far better off consuming your leafy greens as a source of vitamin B.
So anyone listening is probably no stranger to how popular like greens drinks are right now. Greens and reds, mm-hmm, right? Or just the greens. I don't even know what's in the reds, to be honest.
Yeah, that's, I was thinking the exact same thing when you said that. I'm like, why reds?
Beets?
Maybe.
I don't know. What else is there? Tomatoes? I don't even know if that's what it's supposed to be. But greens powders, and I think that there's several companies I can think of that definitely have a strong social media presence. Their marketing budget must be purely towards TikTok, Instagram, etc. And so I definitely get a lot of questions about these greens powders, but it always boils down to, well, what are we eating first, right? A supplement is supposed to supplement what we're eating, and we want to eat this stuff first. So that's just what you've said is like, you know, nail on the head with why those may not be the most beneficial way or the most efficient way to get these vitamins. So I say
so
the
true.
Vitamins,
yeah,
that we need.
So true. Vitamins, whichever way you want to say it, Kate. It's a question I always get asked about, actually, is greens powders or greens and reds powders, whatever we want to call them. I don't want to say people are lazy. I think people just want efficiency, right? And because they are posted so much on social media and adverts, I think the benefit tends to get overplayed massively. Also, they taste really gross. So I always feel like it should be a last-ditch effort in trying to improve your fruit and vegetable intake.
Yeah, I have no problem with them. I think they're not helpful and far more expensive than ground-up spinach or whatever should be. But my beef with them is that it's disgusting. And I don't know, I want things that taste good, like marshmallows.
It's so true. If they taste like soil has been given some sort of like artificial sweetener, like that's pretty much what a greens powder tastes like.
It's a really good description, actually. Spot on.
Yeah, you can even like try and mix it with your protein powder. Don't, it just ruins the protein powder and makes that even worse. So yeah, I'm as you said, I'm not against them, but I would try every other attempt of improving your fruits and vegetable intake before going down that route. Yeah, and then another food that is important is omega-3 fatty acids. And omega-3 fatty acids are often what we call healthy fats. They are polyunsaturated fats that perform important functions in our bodies. Your body can't produce the amount of omega-3s that you need to survive. So omega-3 fatty acids are essential nutrients, meaning you need to get them from the foods you eat. Foods that contain these are certain types of fish, ground flax seeds, walnuts, edamame beans, and a few other things. And omega-3s promote cognition and protect against neurodegeneration, which is a slow and progressive loss of neuronal cells in specified regions of the brain, and is the main pathological feature of certain diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Omega-3 supplementation has been shown to benefit people with the APOE4 gene mutation, which apparently is tied to an increased risk of Alzheimer's. And there's also some evidence suggests that omega-3s can help treat depression too. Epidemiological data shows that depression is less common in nations that eat a lot of fish, which are high in omega-3s. Once again, take that with a grain of salt because many other factors come into play, but there is a link there. And there are several ongoing clinical trials at the moment looking at the effects of adding omega-3s to antidepressant treatments too, and what ratio might actually be beneficial. So it's a really cool area of research, actually.
What's your opinion on fish oil capsules, like supplementing with omega-3s?
Yeah, I think they're helpful. I think they're one of those that they're more helpful than a greens and reds powder, right? Because it depends on your diet setup, especially if when working with vegetarian or vegan clients who tend to lack omega-3s within the diets they consume. If you're selective and careful with it, then you won't need supplementation. But sometimes I think it can be a really handy addition. In the past, when I went through a more of a plant-based eating way than I am now, I did supplement quite a lot with omega-3s, and I did find it helpful. Have to find the right supplement though, because some of them can be a little bit gross and leave kind of little fishy burps, which are always a nice treat.
Disgusting. I take the capsules and I feel like those are better than the oil. But I do take omega-3s. I do take fish oil. And specifically because I've seen that link between benefits for mental health, like depression specifically. And as I've gone through bouts of that myself, I've thought like, you know, you want to do anything to feel better. And so that is like a staple in my supplement regimen, which is creatine and fish oil. Basically, that's all for that reason. And can I say that that has been beneficial for me? I'm not sure, but it just feels like it's worth a try.
Yeah. I mean, even if these links are, it shows a slight benefit, like what's the harm, right? I think it might be worth it. I hear apparently that putting them in the fridge reduces the chance of the fishy burps. I don't know if that's true, and I could have completely spread misinformation to everyone listening to this podcast, but maybe worth a try.
I'll try that next time.
Yeah, although you can get vegan ones as well, vegan omega-3 supplements as well. So, and I think they tend to be a little bit less
disgusting.
Disgusting on the burp front, yeah. Cool, right. So now we're moving on to a bit about gut health. And I don't want to talk about this too much because I appreciate that, Kate, you did cover this in a podcast episode that we did recently. So have you ever felt butterflies in your stomach from anxiety or experienced a gut-wrenching moment? These are all physical proof of the way that your gut is sensitive to emotion. Would you say you're quite an anxious person, Kate? I don't know about you. Like I am, so that's why I asked this question. And I feel like my stomach is very reactive to my mood and stress levels, and it hates me when stress or anxiety levels are high.
Yep, absolutely. Same. And Justin, last week I said something in therapy about being an anxious person. My therapist said, nope, we're going to stop. You're a person with anxious thoughts. And I was like, yeah, right. No, I'm an anxious person.
Thanks for being kind, but no.
Good try. Yes. And I feel like for me, anxiety is very physical. The stomach, like kind of knots churning, mm-hmm. or, you know, something like that is for me, like very much a common manifestation of anxiety when I have a lot to do or I'm late to something. That's a big one for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find that sometimes I'll be like, oh, my stomach's not feeling good. Like, what have I eaten? Like, what have I maybe had that doesn't agree with me? And I'm like, oh no, I haven't. I'm just really stressed and not sleeping very well. And like, I feel like it ties in quite heavily with me and it is very reactive. And as Kate also mentioned in a previous episode, it's such a new area of research, this here. So we don't know all the details yet. However, there are some really cool studies coming out about how directly linked your digestive system is to your brain. This connection is being termed the second brain because the activity in your gut has proven so influential. One major way that the gut can impact mental health is through the secretion of serotonin. Serotonin is an important neurotransmitter that helps regulate sleep, appetite, mood, and pain. And serotonin is made in the gastrointestinal tract. This means that your digestive system can have a direct impact on your mood beyond just whether or not you've enjoyed your lunch. Lack of serotonin is implicated in many mental health conditions, including anxiety and depression. And in fact, many depression treatments aim to increase the availability of serotonin in the brain. The strength of this association as well, I just always want to note, is like it's quite limited in that anxiety and depression are not necessarily caused by an internal imbalance. They can be brought on by any other external factors like poverty, trauma, disease, but they might make it more likely to occur. I think that's the kind of suggestion there.
Yeah, I love that this area of research is something we're learning more and more about because, well, food is so multifaceted, right? Like we know that it's enjoyment and it's nourishment and it's celebration, et cetera, but it also is impacting us on so many internal levels. And that's what we're talking about here today, not just food and mental health, like eating something good makes you happy, but what's happening behind the scenes in our bodies. And how can we foster a relationship with food that is, yes, enjoyable, but also supporting us health-wise, especially in our mental health, which kind of supports us in all the other areas.
Yeah, definitely. And wouldn't it be great if marshmallows were the cure, though? That would be good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I am not opposed to that.
Heading off to my primary care practitioner just to get some marshmallow prescriptions. Right, so now we're going to move on to kind of a few more kind of precise diet approaches here. So some popular diets that have been shown to correlate with improved mental health include the Mediterranean and Japanese diets. The Mediterranean diet emphasizes plant-based foods and healthy fats, as well as veggies, fruits, and whole grains. The Japanese diet also emphasizes whole foods, including fish, seafood, and plant-based proteins. A commonality between the two is a lack of processed foods and an emphasis on fermented foods too, which can act as a probiotic. And as discussed earlier, there's like an intense connection between gut health and brain health. So probiotics that support good gut bacteria may be, strong emphasis on may, they may be very effective in supporting good mental health. Some studies have shown that the Mediterranean and Japanese diets have a 25 to 35% lower risk of depression than those who eat a traditional Western diet. The Western diet generally includes more prepackaged foods, refined grains, red meat, and sugar. These processed foods cause inflammation, which in turn damages the good bacteria that live in your gut. These good bacteria are supposed to protect your intestines from inflammation. I know I'm using so many buzzwords here that I always am a bit like, oh, I'm using like inflammation and they always kind of get banded about and misused. So once again, take this all with a pinch of salt, but this is kind of the tenuous link here. They also have a direct impact on the serotonin pathways from your gut to your brain, and avoiding processed foods may help to preserve the positive effects of your gut bacteria.
I love how much we've talked about these two dietary patterns so far, right? Like, I believe we talked about the Mediterranean diet in the gut health episode, but also we talked about it in the episode on hyperpalatable foods, highly processed foods, right? And that it's less common to find these in the Mediterranean diet patterns. And then in the anti-aging, I've got my air quotes up here, episode, we talked about the Japanese diet. So it's very interesting to note that across many facets of health, we're talking about the same types of dietary patterns. And it's not just about following this diet, right? Because that's not something that we're promoting by any means. It's about what does this dietary pattern focus on and what is less common to find in it.
It's so true. And also, like, importantly on that point as well, is like another notable quality of the Mediterranean diet, which you talk about a lot, is not just the food we eat, but kind of the emphasis on community and kind of like your general approach to food and nutrition. We've spoken about this, as Kate said before on the podcast, but this is often the aspect of the Mediterranean diet that is completely ignored. by a lot of coaches, sources that push certain diet patterns. So eating together is foundational to the Mediterranean diet. And this includes eating with people of other ages, races, classes, genders. And this tradition is great for communal-based approach to food, when the responsibility of making and sharing food falls on everyone, and the benefits of sharing food are felt more broadly. Healthy attitudes regarding food and alcohol consumption are also learned by example, and communal food sharing can promote healthy behaviours in younger generations too. It has been shown that the Mediterranean countries like Italy and France seem to fare better overall in terms of health problems. In contrast with the Mediterranean diet and culture, those in the UK and US, I didn't want to just kind of focus on one of our countries here, Kate. We often try to meet, I did actually just write UK and I was like, no, I need to throw some shade at the US as well whilst I do this. We often try to meet their needs with the nuclear family unit. In a society where it is common for both parents to work, there is not a dedicated parent who is able to cook a meal from scratch every day. This means that for busy adults or parents, processed foods are often the only choice to feed themselves or their families. And it's also true that in both the UK and US, it is easy, cheap, and convenient to eat at fast food restaurants, for example, and more convenient foods. And in a culture that emphasizes work above all else, it can be very difficult to find the time and resources for home cooking and kind of a general more relaxed communal approach to food.
I think that that is true across both cultures. Like, I think that we can make that kind of more sweeping generalization across the UK and the US. And there's pros and cons, right? Like, in some way, processed foods make it easier for us to get those micronutrients we're talking about. We have, you know, flash freeze vegetables and fruits and things like that. And it really does promote more ease in our food choices and in our access to different foods. But then on the flip side, there's also ease around less healthful, less micronutrient-dense mm-hmm. food. So it's kind of double-edged sword there. Because, you know, we're not trashing the frozen or processed foods at all times. There's a time and place for them. But I definitely mm-hmm. see where in having more access, easy access to these foods, kind of more healthful or less processed options do get left by the wayside because they're not necessary.
It's so true. And I'm glad that you kind of made that distinction as well. Like, when we're talking about processed foods, like a lot of this I'm referring to is mostly kind of like nutrient void processed foods, whereas things like freezing vegetables and canning foods, like, are really legit ways of preserving food that doesn't necessarily impact the nutritional value of food. So thank you for that disclaimer, Kate. And in the Journal of Affective Disorders, there was a really cool cohort study in Australia that looked at ultra-processed food intake and whether it was an indicator of depression in adults. And once again, I'll be the first to point out the limitations of a study like this, especially where people are self-reporting food intake. However, it was pretty in-depth, and it did also adjust for socio-demographic characteristics and lifestyle and health-related behaviours too. So it's kind of a bit more legit. Participants with the highest relative intake of ultra-processed food were at an increased risk of psychological distress compared to participants with the lowest intake. There's quite a few research papers that show this link too. I'll link to a few of these actually in the notes in the show notes. So if anyone is a bit of a nerd like us and wants to look through them, then please do. But there was another research paper that showed that individuals reporting higher intakes of ultra-processed foods were significantly more likely to report mild depression, be more mentally unhealthy, and have more anxious days. So the research does tend to show that there is a direct association between kind of ultra-processed food and psychological distress. But once again, the little caveat, there'll be many caveats to this, which I don't want to dismiss in terms of, like, why are people choosing ultra-processed foods? Because they are usually cheaper and more affordable. Although we're kind of encouraging you to make, air quotes, healthy choices with your diet, we appreciate that that's not accessible to everyone. I also just wanted to briefly touch on alcohol here too. I think this is one where people probably know that it's not a good thing to be consuming, but it felt weird covering this topic and not touching on alcohol. So I know also we've covered this in previous episodes too, so please do go back and listen to that episode. I really enjoyed your alcohol episode, Kate, so please do go back and listen to it. But there's links between alcohol intake and poorer mental health outcomes, and they're pretty clear, to be honest. The stats here are taken from the UK government website, and there is an estimated 589,000 people who are dependent on alcohol in England alone, and about a quarter of them are likely to be receiving mental health medication. mostly for anxiety and depression, but also for sleep problems, psychosis, bipolar disorder, and a few other conditions. Alcohol has been described as the UK's favourite coping mechanism, and many of us do drink to try and help manage stress, anxiety, depression, or other mental health problems. And this is sometimes called kind of self-medicating with alcohol. And unfortunately, although alcohol can help us feel relaxed initially and give us a brief feeling of euphoria, the effects are short-lived and the long-term negative consequences of drinking a lot over a period of time can be quite harmful. And I never like to go too political. I mean, I do in person on a podcast, I don't because it tends to turn people off, but I would feel bad not highlighting it here. And for those who are not from the UK, the state of the country right now is upsetting is probably the best word to use. Our Conservative government that we've had for 15 years, is it, or however long, have kind of run it into the ground. Like, income is down, employment rates are really high, mental health services have been stripped to the bone, and there just isn't the support that people need. So unfortunately, more and more people turn to this, and it just worsens the issues there. And I'm sure there's a lot of crossover between here and the US once again, Kate. And until these kind of deep-rooted societal shifts are implemented, we can keep banging on about healthy eating and exercising, and it's going to have a bit of a limited impact.
Right.
I'm not sure if I'm showing my political leanings here too much.
I think that's okay that you are.
I hate this current government. That's all I will say.
If you weren't clear enough to start.
Good.
You know, right, because we're just talking about one facet of how we can improve our mental health here, right? Or maybe not even improve, but touch on. Because a lot of mental health challenges that we may face as individuals have deeper rooted issues, right? Like, this is something that we need maybe therapy, maybe medication, maybe more intense treatment for. But what we're talking about today is that our nutrition also impacts how we're going to feel. So I like to think about or talk about with my clients, like, we always have controllables and uncontrollables in our lives, right? Like, we can't control what the weather is like or the food that's going to be served on a specific menu or, you know, whatever. There's so many uncontrollables out there, but we do usually in our midst have a few controllables. And so if we take that idea and slap this lens of mental health on it, maybe past trauma or really hard things we've been through or family dynamic, whatever that may look like, those may be uncontrollable to some extent, but we do still have, for the most part, ability to support ourselves through our nutrition, maybe through movement, to the best of our capacity in a way to make things a little bit better. And as someone who has struggled with depression, like, it was very limiting for me in how I could show up and live life normally. Like, you want to feel just a little bit better if you can, right? That actually just made me think of, I don't know if we want to go into all this. Like, there was a point where I was trying to get on a medication. I was dealing with really bad panic attacks for like a 2-year period, and I was trying to get this under control, et cetera. And at like the worst point, I could only eat King's Hawaiian rolls. Do you know what those are?
So I don't know what these are, so you're going to have to elaborate.
It's just like
here.
A sweet roll. It's just like a little bread roll, and it's sweet. Mm-hmm. Obviously, nice. I trend towards liking sugar. And I was just thinking, oh man, maybe greens powders would have been good at that point. Because I'm just thinking back at, like, you know, my nutrition was not supportive at all at that point, but I was just trying to eat whatever I could. So I guess we take all this with a grain of salt, because if you told me to eat a vegetable at that point, I would have been like, goodbye.
Yeah, and I think the reason, like, I wanted to do this topic is because I appreciate that a lot of people don't have the choice, okay? Like, let's just kind of say it as black and white as it is. Some people don't have the choice to kind of make the decisions around their nutrition. However, some of us do. I think it's important to highlight the link between nutrition and mental health. Even if people don't have the capacity to make the choice, I think it's important to highlight that health outcomes and health status isn't always dependent on just the actions that we take. And there's a wider picture here, such as society needing to change to have food more accessible, have healthcare more accessible, have food more kind of affordable too. Like, a lot of the cheap food that we see is really highly processed and low nutrients. If we can start or amplify the message of, right, this is really important, if we can get people eating well, everything else improves, then I think it just kind of adds to the armory of look how important this is and everything needs to change to make people feel better. I don't know if I'm wording that very well, but I think it's an important discussion to have, even if people's capacity to make the choices are quite limited.
Right. I think, no, I love what you're saying, because it's about the knowledge, right? Like, we can empower ourselves with the knowledge about how our nutrition can impact our mental health, period. Maybe that's all we can, maybe that's the controllable in someone's current set of circumstances. And I think that's a powerful one. So that's why we're here talking about it. But individual circumstances are going to limit what we can actually do with this information. But I think it's powerful and empowering information to have regardless.
Yeah, it's so true. And it always really angers me when some people get really defensive when you cover this topic too. I actually did a post about this on Instagram the other day, talking about kind of how privileged we are to be able to make a choice around our diets. Like, for people that choose a plant-based or vegan diet, there is privilege in having the choice and accessibility and the income to afford all the things you need to do to that sensibly. There's always people in the comments when you talk about that saying that you're talking nonsense and that it's not a privilege. Everyone can make those decisions. And I don't know why people are so often short-sighted in this. I don't know whether it's like a defense mechanism for them sticking up for their favorite diet approach, or whether people are just occasionally really judgmental and don't want others to kind of be lifted up alongside them. I don't know what it is, but I do feel it's important to keep banging the drum about this, even if it pisses off a lot of internet trolls.
Agree.
Yeah. So something else I also wanted to touch upon is nutritional psychiatry. I don't know if you kind of explored this area much or know too much about it, Kate. I actually didn't until researching this, but it kind of makes sense. And it also makes sense about why some topics I talk about, I get quite bizarre accounts posting comments disagreeing with me. And I think they're part of this group. That's all I'll say. So the reason I say briefly touching on this topic is because I'm a bit wary to give it too much credit as well, because I think a lot of people, not all, I'm sure there are some that are great, that work within this space that are problematic is maybe the best word to use, or at least like a little bit short-sighted. Potential benefits can often get blown out of proportion, and sometimes a bit more balance is needed, hence why I'm trying to tackle this topic in quite like a balanced way, and I keep on giving little side notes. So sorry to anyone listening to this who maybe works in this field and gets a bit offended. I'm sure you're great. There are some great people in every field. There's people that exploit it, just like personal trainers and nutrition coaches like us, Kate. So where was I? So nutritional psychiatry is an emerging field that aims to explore how the type of food you eat impacts your brain's functionality. And it focuses on the use of food and supplements to provide these essential nutrients as part of an integrated or alternative treatment for mental health disorders. One study from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found that increasing, this isn't kind of groundbreaking by any means, but like increasing fruit and vegetable consumption has a positive impact on psychological well-being. And vegetables were pretty influential in the positive effect. And another study divided a group of men aged 18 to 25 with diagnosed depression into two groups. The control group continued with a normal diet. The other was put on the Mediterranean diet, buzzword. The group on the Mediterranean diet showed a much greater improvement in depressive symptoms after 12 weeks. And the studies support the idea that food can be used potentially as a kind of therapeutic tool. I'm using air quotes again. But as I kind of said with the disclaimer here, if people are kind of encouraging us to do this alongside treatment that is proven to work, I'm kind of all for it. If they're saying, right, here's what you're taking to improve your situation, this diet approach might help too. Don't have any issues. That sounds awesome. It's when people say, don't take medication. It's nonsense. Follow this diet approach instead. And conveniently, I have lots of supplements to sell alongside of it. And that's what I have an issue with. So that's why I thought it's quite cool to touch on this kind of nutritional psychiatry topic, but also just give a slight disclaimer there.
Yeah, I don't even know if I've heard necessarily that phrase, nutritional psychiatry. It makes sense. And I'm, like you're saying, I'm all for it in conjunction with treatment that may be needed outside of it. It's the food is medicine folk who kind of pose more harm than any like supposed harm that medication could pose. Food has many functions. Supporting our health can be one. Playing a role in medications can be one. But it's not always a replacement for medication.
Very well said. If someone anyone, a coach, a friend, someone random on social media is telling you to stop your medication and to follow their diet approach instead, or to take their supplement that you've probably never heard of, run away, because it's not safe. It's probably the blanket answer. Yeah, ask questions. Okay, so kind of just a few practical tips then. So what are some ways that we can implement better nutrition for mental health? And the easiest way is quite boring once again, and it's to consume more fruits and vegetables. Like if you start with that as your baseline, you're going to do pretty well. You can cook your vegetables in healthy fats, like omega-3 fatty acids, as I mentioned, like olive oil, and pair them with some sources of omega-3s, like fish or eggs, for example. And these combinations may create a great nutritional foundation to support brain health. And it's also important to choose foods that you like and will enjoy eating on a regular basis. And like with any nutritional recommendations that we make, the kind of longevity and long-term application of diet changes are the most important thing. Don't force yourself to eat Brussels sprouts if you hate them, for example. Yes, Kate?
So I think it's an important caveat here to make that we're adults. I'm assuming most who are listening to this are adults. We have the power to make our food taste good. Adults who don't like vegetables, that's okay. We can also learn to like them. Use seasonings. Get an air fryer. Do things that taste good, because I just feel so strongly about this, because if we're still an adult like trying to avoid eating veggies, something's got to change. And something that may have been missing is making your food taste good. You know? Do you have an air fryer, Michael?
We do, and I love it. I resisted an air fryer for so long, and everyone online was like, get an air fryer, it's amazing. And then you get one and you're like, damn it, I'm going to be one of those idiots that's commenting, get an air fryer on everyone's post, because it's so easy.
I don't have one right now, and I miss it a lot.
But
I just haven't, because we have like, we live in a furnished home, so it has so much kitchen crap in it already, and I just like... avoiding getting more, but it's going to happen soon, because broccoli in an air fryer, come
it's
on
good.
People, you're missing out.
They take up a lot of space, don't they?
That's what
air
it
fryers
is.
are always massive. Yeah,
and the way they're shaped, like, never fits in a drawer or anything. That's really why I don't have one yet. I had one when we lived in the US. I've had one always until we moved to Mexico, but it's only time to get one, because I like vegetables, but this is like leveling up.
It's so good. It just gives them like a little bit of a crunch, like just gives it a bit more flavor to it, right? And we bought like a single drawer one. Sorry, we're just going to go on air fryer chat now, which is massive. But I kind of wish we got the two drawer one, but then I'm thinking, I don't even know if it would fit in our kitchen.
Right.
Yeah. But they are good. Anyone considering it?
It's a sacrifice that's often worth making. That's what I'll say. Anyway, this isn't about air fryers. This is about enjoying our food. Carry on.
It should be about air fryers, Kate. Eat more fruits and vegetables. And along with food, it's also essential for your brain to stay hydrated too. I've not touched too much on hydration, but I mean, our brain is 75% water. So I think it goes without saying that kind of dehydration can have a serious negative impact on self-esteem, short-term memory, attentional abilities, for example, and can also cause fatigue. I'm sure we've all felt that when we're feeling dehydrated. And drinking enough water throughout the day can support your mental acuity. Do you get massively impacted by hydration? I feel like I'm really, once again, sensitive to it. And as soon as I slack, I feel awful. Like everything feels awful.
I think this is the curse of being a hydrated person. Like for me, water is a habit, right? Like I drink a lot of water, but the moment I don't get enough, I call myself a craisin, like a Kate Raisin. The moment I don't get enough, I'm like, oh, my skin, my throat, like I am so parched.
I think it's like that with any healthy habits, that if you've ever sustained healthy habits for a long period of time, as soon as you let them slip, you're like, oh, this is how awful people feel when they don't exercise or don't stay hydrated. So I think it's like that, isn't it? If you really focus on hydration for a good period of time, as soon as you let it slack, just brain feels horrible, energy levels suck, your sleep sucks as well. It's just not good. Digestive system runs much smoother, without going into more information. Like it's just everything improves. So If we don't take anything away from this episode other than this one point, I will be happy, and it's drink more water. You will feel great.
Get a fun water bottle. I'm here with the practical tips. Like, you don't like your water? Get a really fun water bottle. Not a Stanley. They're so overrated. I have mine sitting right here. It is so top heavy and it falls over all the time.
Get right. So the Stanley's like the TikTok one, right? That everyone bought from social media.
Probably. I'm not on TikTok, but it seems like every female in their 20s to 50s has one, if that's what you're talking about. And there's jokes about how huge it is. Yeah, that one.
I resisted it because I think they look quite ugly. No offense to your water bottle, Kate. I'm not a big fan of the way they look.
You know, a friend got me this when I was breastfeeding because you need to like really, really stay on top of your hydration. Yeah, yeah, so it's great because it's like 40 something ounces. I think it's 42. Mm-hmm. So it's nice. You don't have to refill all the time, but it's top heavy. It's just, it's not practical at all. Yeah. Get a better water bottle.
For Emma, when she was pregnant, I bought her, like, you know, when you see like the gym bros walking around the gym with like the massive tank of like probably got BCAAs or something in it. I bought her one of those and it's so good. Like, fill it like water for like 3 days in it. It's great.
Those are hilarious, but they work. It's practical. And I don't think we can end this topic without talking about eating enough, right? Let's go back to what you said in the beginning of the script. You were talking about like brain fog and hanger when we are underfueled. I mean, that is true across the board, whether our mental health feels like it's in a really great place or not. But if we're not eating enough, we're just adding fuel to the fire of not feeling our best. And it never fails to surprise me how many people are going through life so underfueled, just not living in a way that they could feel better, both mentally and physically. And I think that plays a big role in mental health as well.
It's so true. And it's really sad. The amount of people I work with who, it's often women, I don't want to stereotype, but it usually is, just because society encourages them to not eat very much. And I'll say, right, this is the amount of food I now want you to eat. And they'll be like, oh my God, this is too much food. Like, I cannot eat that amount of food. And it's already, like, it's still not enough. It's just a stepping stone to getting to where you need to be. So many people are underfueling. And I don't know how you can expect yourself to thrive if you're restricting your body of the food it needs to just like maintain a basic functioning level, right? So yeah, it's such an important point and a great one to finish on.
Do you get hangry?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I really do.
You said that so strongly, so I just really believe.
Emma always comments on it. She's like, I hate you when you're hungry. Like, I'll just like, I don't do anything. Like, I need food. In the UK, we have a chocolate bar called a Snickers. Do you have a Snickers chocolate bar?
From the US.
Oh, okay. Right. We need to talk about this chocolate bar. I don't know where it's from either. Yeah. So there was like did you get the adverts for them as well? And it's like, you're not you when you're hungry.
Have a
like,
Snickers. Have a Snickers. Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's literally me. Yeah. I'm usually like a pretty mellow, calm person, but the only time I'm not is when I'm hungry. I can just imagine my wife listening to us talking about this when she listens back to this episode, chuckling to herself, because yeah, I do. I get very hangry. Do you?
Yeah. I don't know if it's that bad. Kenny doesn't get hangry at all. I don't even get it, but I'm just like short and snippy. Like, dumb question you just asked me. So yeah.
That's me. That's me as well.
So,
yeah.
You know, I talk with my clients often about hanger. Like, let's not let ourselves get to that point. And when we're hangry or we have this like super hunger, you know, just eating away at us, we know that our decision-making abilities are impaired. We are not in the right state. We're not ourselves. Like, listen, our personalities change essentially is what we're saying. Because I'd say both of us are pretty chill people. So imagine what that looks like consistently over time being underfueled. Like, that's really impactful if just being hungry for an afternoon because you haven't had a snack impairs our decision-making abilities. Think about what it's like to be chronically underfueled and how that's going to impact our overall mental health, cognitive function, et cetera. That's just my plug to eat more.
A perfect plug to finish on. Thank you, Kate. And that wraps up our episode. There we go.
I loved this one. I did.
Cool.
I feel like I learned some good things too.
Good. I'm glad. It's a really cool topic. And once again, one that kind of gets overplayed massively also, but also gets underrepresented as well. when you're kind of working in the nutrition space. So yeah, like, please, we welcome feedback as always with these episodes. If you have any questions or topic suggestions for future episodes, please just let us know. And I think that's it. Should we wrap it up there?
Yeah. I would love to hear from any listeners if you feel like your nutrition has impacted your mental health, or if you've been through a period of time where it felt more or less impactful. I'd be really interested to hear. I definitely have my own stories and experience, so I'm curious how that compares to others out there.
Perfect. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We'll see you all again next week.